Okay, so my guest today is Angela Walsh. Angela is an associate professor at St. Mary's University School of Law. Her research focuses on money and the law, blockchain technologies, governance of emerging technologies, and financial stability. She is a research fellow of the Centre for Blockchain Technologies at the University College London. She was nominated for the Blockchain Person of the Year Award in 2016 by CryptoCoin News for her work on the governance of blockchain technologies and for her influential article in the American Banker arguing that the coders and miners of public blockchains should be treated as fiduciaries. So, welcome to the show, Angela.
Thanks so much, John. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm very glad you could join me for this conversation today, Angela. And as I mentioned to you in our correspondence beforehand, I want to use the podcast as an opportunity to go through some of the arguments and ideas that are in your paper, The Path of the Blockchain Lexicon and the Law. Now, for all the non-law people listening, the title of this paper is a riff off Oliver Wendell Holmes' famous Harvard Law Review article, The Path of Law. And in part of that article, Holmes laments some of the confused and moralistic terminology that infects legal practice and legal doctrine. Now, your article offers a similar lament about the current state of play with respect to blockchain technologies. Now, lots of people are enthusiastic about the revolutionary potential of blockchain technologies, and I've had guests on in the past who have discussed some of these revolutionary potentials. And if you pay attention to what they say, you'll know that they use a kind of bewildering array of familiar sounding but often esoteric terms to describe how it all works. So they refer to things such as shared ledgers, distributed consensus, trustlessness, immutability, miners, nodes, proof of work, and so on. Now, your main thesis is that confusion surrounding the meaning of these terms has negative implications for anyone who's trying to regulate or manage blockchain technologies. And what I'm hoping over the course of this conversation is that we can tease out exactly why you believe that. Yeah, I'm going to start with a question then, which I always ask guests at the outset, which is to define their terms. Now, I appreciate that this is quite ironic in the present case, since part of your argument is that it's difficult to define the terms. But despite that irony, I think it might be useful to ask you to define some of the concepts and ideas that are used in the discussion about blockchain technologies. And perhaps in the course of trying to define these things, we can illustrate the problem of definition that is the real focus of your paper. So let me start with the first question, which is what is a blockchain?
Yes, the big question that nobody knows the answer to. So there's a big fight going on in the world right now over what a blockchain is. There are many different definitions of this term. I'll offer some things that are part of defining it. There are some things that are common to, I think, what people mean when they say a blockchain. One of those is that you are keeping a record of some sort. It's sometimes referred to as a ledger. It's easy to refer to it as just a record of some sort. And the changes to the record, another common element to this, is that the changes to the record are made by a network of parties rather than by a single party. Okay. And there's, as you go deeper down the hole, you find out that network can be a limited group of parties who know and trust one another, or it can be anyone in the world who decides to become part of the network. I think that another thing common to what people mean about blockchain is that there is some cryptography involved in the process. So the cryptographic algorithms are used on data before it is put onto this record, and that helps to strengthen the record and give it resilience and make it more secure. Now, there are lots of varieties of blockchains, and some people call them distributed ledgers, some people call them shared ledgers, and we're getting to a point maybe where people think that a blockchain is a subset of a distributed ledger, but people don't refer to these structures consistently. People call them the blockchain, a blockchain, DLT, SLT, mutual distributed ledger, mutual shared ledgers, and it's unclear when people talk about them what the differences are and if they're acknowledging differences in the data structure they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the early days, it was relatively easy to know what you were talking about because there was only one blockchain associated with Bitcoin. But now, since there are multiple platforms, there are multiple blockchains, and there are all these slight kind of variations on the same basic theme. So you probably have like a a family tree type situation.
Yes. So one, you know, one of the things that makes clear kind of what you're saying is that, right, there originally was one single blockchain, Bitcoin was the originator of this. And, you know, as the discussion has gone from the world of kind of coders and into the world, the rest of the world, where we don't all know the coding vocabulary, one very common way of confusing things is to refer to the blockchain does this. And you can't really refer to the blockchain, right? Because as noted, there are many blockchains with different features, and the blockchain doesn't have any features. It's a meaningless thing, but people nonetheless continue to refer to it that way, the technology.
Yeah, just a couple of things that came up in that kind of cluster of concepts or terms that you associate with the idea of the blockchain. This distinction between a distributed ledger versus a shared ledger. Why do people make that distinction? Is the distinction, does it have any significance or meaning?
You know, I'm not the one who's been pushing those particular terms, but I think shared ledger actually, it may capture the spirit of the technology a bit better. To me, actually, the new thing, or one of the key new things about this technology is that it is inherently about doing group work. Okay, so a group of people come together and decide we're going to keep a record together, and we're sharing the labor of that. So maybe sharing it captures that spirit a bit more. I think it depends on what you're focusing on about what is distinctive about the technology. So distributed ledger gets at the fact that there are more copies of the ledger. So, but maybe it doesn't get to the point of like it's the act of the people sharing things that is the important part. To me, that distinction doesn't have too much meaning.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one thing that occurs to me is that at least when I hear the term distributed, it carries connotations that the work is or the. Yeah, the work of maintaining the blockchain is spread out amongst many people, but that isn't necessarily the case because you can have quite a tight-knit or close-knit group who's managing it. Perhaps sharing is better in that sense. I mean, that brings me to the other question that I wanted to ask, though, is that the different types of blockchain that are out there now, so the public versus private blockchain and the permissioned versus permissionless blockchain, maybe you could explain what those differences or distinctions are.
Okay, so that refers to purely who is part of the network involved in maintaining the blockchain. So a permissionless, also called a public or an open blockchain, is one that's like Bitcoin, meaning that there are no limits or permissions on the parties who are able to join the validation network. All that you have to do is download the software, which is publicly available, and start processing. Of course, over time, it's become much more expensive to become part of that network in a meaningful way, as far as if you want to be a miner on that network. But that's the open or permissionless public blockchain. The private blockchain is a totally different beast, and it's interesting to me that people call both of these structures blockchains. They seem to be fundamentally different. So the private or permissioned or closed blockchain is one that has as its network of validators only parties that are known and trusted to one another. So to me, a private blockchain is really just kind of a joint venture activity. You know, the relationship between the parties in the network would be governed by a contract in which you lay out the terms on which you're keeping this record together. So they're very different beasts, and I think they they likely raise very different risks and have different capabilities. But it's interesting, people often fail to make a distinction about what they are talking about, whether they are referring to the capability of a public blockchain versus a private blockchain, and that can be very problematic. The private blockchains have been primarily used and are being experimented with by the financial sector. They've kind of said that for now, public blockchains are too foreign or too different to meet our needs.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I probably agree with you in the sense that the notion of a private blockchain seems to be very counter to the original spirit or intention behind the technology, at least as I understand it, as being something that is is open source or is shared and is not... You don't need to have those more personalized networks of trust between the people who are maintaining it. I mean, that's something we might get back to later on, but yeah, the private blockchain, as you've described it, seems to be very contrary to that original spirit or ethos.
Yes, so the people who inhabit the public blockchain space are very dismissive of those in the private blockchain space because they say that they're missing the fundamental innovation here, which is allowing people who don't trust each other to work together on a single task.
Yeah, so I mean, there are other terms and concepts that are probably important to touch upon, at least. What's the relationship or association between blockchain technologies and currencies? This is something that I've actually, I'm not sure I'm entirely clear on at all times either, but obviously blockchain technologies were originally associated with Bitcoin, which is a virtual currency. Yeah, sorry, what makes it a virtual currency? And then also, do you need a currency to have a blockchain at all? Because, I mean, Ethereum has some kind of currency, but I don't understand why it needs to have the currency. So what's the association between a blockchain and a currency?
Yes, as you know, blockchain technology is said to be the technology behind Bitcoin, and people have described blockchain technology as a sort of platform technology for which we are trying to, or in the process of discovering potential applications. And the first application was Bitcoin. So using the technology to for the purpose of a currency. So it's once you go down this rabbit hole, it makes you ask all the questions about what money and currency actually is. Does money have to be a thing, a physical thing? Is it just an idea? Is it a sign? Is it just some sort of social agreement that we all have with one another to believe that something has value? And so if you say that you have a Bitcoin, it's really just something that people made up within this and transfer back and forth to one another just in this record. So because the parties have agreed that there are a limited number of these Bitcoins, you know, again, just this made-up concept that will ever exist, this 21 million limit. People have ascribed value to them. And it, to me, this whole system definitely points to, you know, money as a social construct, money as record-keeping. And I think it's actually really kind of an illuminating thing. Money has also been referred to, or you can think of it as our whole system is just a way of tracking who has kind of what resources. If I have money, the money that I bring represents to the person I want to buy something from that I am entitled to X amount of resources. And it's just when we use cash and stuff, it's just a representation, our tracking system of who has what. So currencies, yes, the first manifestation, the first app for blockchain technology, and a number of the other blockchains that have come out since Bitcoin also have these, sometimes you call them tokens. So Ether is the one on Ethereum. There's also Zcash, the privacy-enhanced blockchain. And there's the whole phenomenon going on right now with what are called ICOs, initial coin offerings, in which people are selling these tokens, they're calling them, for the particular blockchain to allow participation in it. And people are analogizing those now to securities, essentially selling shares of stock in an enterprise. So all of this kind of highlights how blurry the distinctions are when you're talking about interests and value of things that are not tangible.
Yeah, I mean, I think on the definition of money and the rabbit hole that you're referring to there, I would just direct listeners to this podcast, to an earlier podcast I did with Rachel O'Dwyer, which was all about money and the definitions of money, and then spoke a bit about Bitcoin. But I mean, I'm very much in favor of the view that money is a social construct, and that all currencies are virtual, and that the attempt to link currency to a commodity is misleading. But that's a separate debate. But I'm still not clear. So on like Ethereum, and maybe it's important to maybe back up and explain this. But as I understood it, Ethereum is a blockchain platform, open source. People can write their own applications on top of it. But it was designed or created with the intention of facilitating other kinds of contractual relationships, I guess, via the blockchain. So you can have smart contracts and smart property or distributed organizations. Why does Ethereum need a currency, or why does it need a token of value or exchange token on the network? Why is it essential or not?
I'm not sure that I'm the right person to answer that. I know that there's divergent beliefs on this topic. So the variations that we were talking about of the technology, one of the variations that we have seen is that some people choose to have a token on their system and some don't. One of the reasons that people cite for having a token is that, and this is sort of part of this ICO phenomenon, is that including a token in your system enables the funding of the software development, essentially all the activities that will happen on the blockchain. It's just people buying tokens at the beginning is essentially paying the developers to do the work on these open structures. So that's a very common problem in open source software projects, is the ones that kind of emerge grassroots from the software development community, is that there's no way of paying these people. That's obvious. So that can be a hindrance on development, particularly if the software becomes important and a lot of people are counting on it and no one is being paid to work on it or to devote adequate attention to it. So people and a bunch of venture capitalists are talking that ICOs and this token model are going to be a part of kind of revolutionizing this funding of open source software, enabling all these great new things to happen, because now we have a clear way of paying, of funding it, essentially. So I think that may be a part of this. I don't have a good explanation right now. I want to think about that a little bit, about why is the token necessary? It's part of the record keeping process, but it's not a question that I've considered deeply yet.
Yeah, I think that the answer you gave is certainly plausible, that it's something to do with incentivizing and rewarding the people who are building these open source applications. Just another question on definitions. So when we talk about blockchain technologies, there are people who are involved in maintaining and updating the ledger or the record. And there are terms used to describe these people. Miner is the most common term. And then you also have people who are running nodes, partial nodes or full nodes. Could you maybe explain the difference between those two things, like what's a miner and what's the difference between a partial node and a full node?
So a miner is a party in this computer network, the validating network, who's contributing their computing power to doing what's necessary, essentially, to make changes to the record. So it was originally called a miner because, at least in Bitcoin, the party who ends up you know, being the one who processes a group of transactions, which will be added to the record, receives a reward, and the reward in Bitcoin is a certain number of Bitcoins are attributed to the miner. They get an entry on a ledger saying they own X number of new Bitcoins, and that number awarded shifts over time to become less and less over time. But the idea was that they were called miners because they were essentially, you know, finding new Bitcoins, kind of like miners for gold found new gold. So that's why they're called miners, but they're really just validators of transactions, of events on the network. And through that validation, changes are made to this ledger or record. So nodes in the network are parties who are also in this computer network, and partial nodes and full nodes are different because it has to do with whether they store a complete copy of the record on their system. So this kind of is tied to one of the big questions about the technology, because the idea behind the technology is that it's so beneficial because you have a record that goes back essentially to the beginning of time, the moment of creation of the technology, and you're tracking every single thing that is happening relevant to that system. So in the Bitcoin system, you're tracking the movement of every Bitcoin and every part of a Bitcoin all the way back to the beginning of the creation of the system. Well, that's a lot of information. If every party on the network has to store all of that information, that's taking up a lot of storage space, right? It's as if, I mean, one way to think of it might be, we have governments to keep certain records, like everybody's birth certificate or whatever, but if we all had to keep a copy of everybody's so that we could, you know, all know that everything was true back to the beginning of time, that storage would quickly become immense. So one of the tweaks that has been made in these systems is to enable parties to participate to not have to have the entire full copy of the record on their computer. But that undermines some of the trustlessness, I guess, to use a problematic term, of the system.
Yeah, I mean, so it seems that the great strength, or one of the touted benefits of the technology, was the fact that everyone is keeping this record, and so you're not relying upon centralized repositories or data storage. But mm-hmm. as you're pointing out, as the record grows, it becomes less feasible for everybody to keep a record, and so people run partial nodes. But then it does seem, to an extent, like the people who are running partial nodes are both perhaps free riding on the labor or computing power provided by others, but also then dependent on those others to maintain the record for them, which, yeah, it, again, seems to me like it's contrary to the original spirit or ethos of the technology itself.
Yes, I agree.
Now, so we've defined a lot of terms there, I appreciate, and there are a bunch of evaluative terms that people use to describe blockchains, such as that they are trustless, which you just mentioned, that they're immutable, that they're secure. I think we'll just hold off on those terms for the time being, because they become a central focus of the argument in your paper. And I hope as well, just like, from this initial conversation, people can see some of the confusion around what a blockchain is, what the core features of a blockchain are, the differences between different types of blockchains. Why does this terminological confusion arise? Why are people so confused in the language that they use to describe blockchain technology?
So I think there are a number of factors that have contributed to this. So one of them has to do with the diversity of fields that come together with blockchain technology. So it's really interesting once you start to think about it, and probably why it's been so interesting to so many different types of people is that it brings together fields like computer science, software engineering, economics, game theory, law, philosophy, sociology, all of these different fields come together to think about how this technology works. And so it's very cross-cutting, but the problem with this from a confusion standpoint is that each of these fields brings their own jargon to the discussion and their own way of thinking about things. And you can have misunderstandings happen when a term that means one thing in one field is used and people in another field interpret it differently. And this can also happen even if you're not coming to this from any particular discipline. The lay understanding of a word may be very different from the understanding of a word in a particular field. And that's what this paper, as you noted in your introduction, I called it the Path of the Blockchain Lexicon, definitely referring to that Holmes piece, Path of the Law, because he talks about how the moral language in law, such as, you know, calling things duties, which a normal person would apply, maybe you have some sort of moral duty, but in a legal sense, it means something very different. The lay interpretation of a word has a different meaning than the specialized jargon, and that can create confusion. So that's definitely one thing that I think is contributing to this here. There may be computer scientists and software people and the cryptographers, the cypherpunk group that the technology originally emerged from may have assigned meanings to words that differ from the lay meaning. So we'll talk about that more, but I think immutable and trustless were ones that were assigned to this technology early on, and they mean very different things to the layperson than they mean in this context. So that's one thing. There are other things that have contributed to this confusion, and so I think it's happened over time. There's been some taint that has happened to the various words in the system. So was associated and is still to some extent with kind of this criminal underworld, like Silk Road and money laundering, those types of things. And a lot of the early businesses in the ecosystem were called bit whatever, to kind of tie themselves to Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was, the name Bitcoin, I think, became somewhat tainted. So names of companies have been changed. The discussion shifted to talking more about blockchain technology, and people have just kind of moved. So to me, this whole phenomenon points to, you know, that language is a very fluid thing. We're always responding, and meanings of words are changing. They're becoming more positive or more negative. And so you want to come up with a new word, maybe that to shake the baggage kind of that the old word has taken on. So that's another factor in all of this. And then it has made sense to add new words sometimes as the technology has changed. As we were discussing earlier, there are now a whole lot of variations that have been made to the technology, and new words have come in to attempt to distinguish the new from the old. As you're adding the new terms, sometimes people just don't communicate clearly, so they just continue to misuse words. So you're adding new words, but people are not making the distinctions between, you know, when it's appropriate to use a new word versus when it's appropriate to use the old word. And then, you know, finally, we're always, you know, as I was talking about language moving, we're always just kind of rethinking things. And this is a new technology that is experimental and is maturing. And words change in it as people realize, well, maybe that wasn't exactly precisely what I meant. Maybe the word I chose the first time is not quite right. So I'm going to add a new word to describe the capabilities or what I'm doing here. And again, because just this transitional state, and because there's a big group of people working on it, the meanings don't all get out clearly. There is a lag in when people begin to use the new or, you know, more precise meaning, and it just kind of all ends up in a muddle.
Yeah, so that's a very comprehensive explanation of where the confusion arises from, and as in a sense, what you're describing there is a phenomenon that's common in many sort of nascent disciplines or fields where terminology gets developed and expanded and then confused over time as people start using it in different ways. And yeah, I think that should be a familiar story to many people. And as you were talking, I was thinking how actually the term miner is a very good example of this as well, where it's used by analogy in the initial case of Bitcoin because of the analogy with gold mining, but it has quite a technical meaning. So, you know, lay people understand it in one sense, the people who are technically proficient to understand it in another sense, but they appreciate the analogy as well. But then as the technology develops and new applications arise, that term sort of carries over and continues on in ways that might be actually fundamentally misleading, or the analogy that originally held in the case of Bitcoin breaks down in those subsequent applications.
Yes.
Okay, so, I mean, one of the arguments in your paper then is that the terminological confusion creates problems for people who are trying to regulate this technology, so lawyers or legal officials who are trying to manage it and address the risks associated with it. Now, that argument is dependent on the assumption that this is a technology that ought to be regulated. But, I mean, again, to go back to the idea that there's a certain ethos or spirit behind the technology originally, Bitcoin, as I understood it, was very much an attempt to create a currency or system that was free from regulatory or state interference. So, I mean, isn't there kind of an inherent tension between the technology and regulation anyway that goes over and, over and above the terminological problems? And also then, why do we want to regulate the technology?
Great question.
There are two questions there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll try to parse them out. These open or permissionless blockchains like Bitcoin come from a place of being wanting to be outside the world of law and regulation. And, that comes across through the desire to not have to identify yourself when you're participating in the system, that they're not fully anonymous, but it's hard to find out who is participating in the system. You'd have to go through some effort to actually tie an IP address to a particular person. So wanting to stay out of that, that whole world of law is definitely part of this. I don't want the impression to be that because I am describing the problems that the confusion raises for regulators, that I am saying that the technology definitively needs to be regulated. I don't know whether that's the case yet or not, and I think it's premature to know that. However, it is extremely important for the people who do regulate things to be able to understand the technology in order to figure out if it needs to be regulated, or to understand how use of the technology might impact fields and practices that they do regulate. Okay, so if you can't understand something and you don't understand the risks, then you can't make good decisions about it. So I'm not claiming that you have to regulate the technology. Indeed, that may be the wrong approach because maybe it does make more sense just to continue to focus on activities that the technology ends up being used for and to stay technology agnostic. But you can't know that unless you can understand it. And all the confusion around the language makes it much harder to understand. And while I focused this paper on advice for regulators, I don't think the advice that I give and this problem of confusion is just one that affects regulators. I think it absolutely affects policymakers generally, because people are not just trying to figure out the technology for the purpose of figuring out, well, do we need to write a law about it? They're also trying to figure out in many government settings whether this is technology that they want to use in important government systems like property records, like voting. So all of this confusion makes it similarly hard for policymakers and those who are considering adopting the technology to figure it out. This piece is directed primarily at regulators, it should also be relevant for those groups of people. And since I'm a law professor, you know, I have to talk about regulation.
Yeah, of course. But one thing that occurred to me there, which hadn't occurred to me before now, but when I look at Bitcoin in particular, you know, there's a lot of hype about that initially. There's a lot of hype about it at the moment because it seems to have, I guess it's peaked in terms of its value. I haven't actually checked the current market value of Bitcoin, but it increased fairly dramatically in the first half of this year. So there's a lot of hype initially and some hype now, but there was an attempt by regulators to say something about Bitcoin early on. You know, how is it going to be defined for the purposes of law? How should we treat it? Should it be completely outlawed or banned, or should it be viewed as a type of property and taxed in that way? And my sense is that certainly in Europe although there are different approaches taken by different countries, there's no systematic European-wide regulation of Bitcoin. I think that's still the case.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think regulators are still trying to figure it out. I think in the U.S., so we have that whole our system is confusing in part because we have a whole bunch of different regulators, and in the U.S., each regulator has tried to say something about Bitcoin, and you know, is it property, is it a commodity, etc. But I think there's still a lot of uncertainty out there from the regulation, from the regulatory perspective. And actually, one of the concerns in the industry is that there is regulatory uncertainty now, and that could be actually holding back innovation. So that's the dilemma of when is the time to regulate, right? You don't want to regulate too soon because that could harm innovation. You don't want to regulate too late because that could harm innovation by creating this uncertainty. So we're somewhere in the middle there, I think, right now.
Yeah, so I think you kind of answered the question I had, which is just that, like, what's the cause of this sort of delay or degree of reticence on the part of regulators? Is it because they're confused about the technology itself, or is it because of that issue about, well, is it the right time to regulate? Should we be regulating this technology at all? I guess it's possibly both of those things at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think both are contributing to that.
Yeah. We've already touched a little bit on the problems that the terminological confusion poses for regulators. But there are two big problems that you mentioned in the paper that I wanted to discuss, which is just the problem of inconsistency and then the problem of perverse innovation that's caused by terminological confusion. So could you just maybe talk about those two problems and how they might arise and do arise?
Okay, so the first one, inconsistency across jurisdictions. So I think that this could arise if people just have perhaps different understandings of what the capabilities of the technology are, and those misunderstandings can come about through the vocabulary problems that I've talked about, and they could result in different jurisdictions, because of their different understandings of the capabilities of the technology, coming up with very different types of laws, even though the technology is the same, and even though the regulators may actually have the same regulatory goal. So, for instance, I could see this coming up in maybe the evidentiary value that is attributed to a blockchain record. So there have been several jurisdictions where the legislature has said, well, we want to make sure that blockchain records are viewed as legitimate or authoritative, and have passed legislation to that effect. Well, that can all depend on, you know, how authoritative we should view a blockchain record to be. Is what is in the record truthful, or should we assume it to be truthful? Just because it is in, you know, a blockchain record, should we assume that it has not been tampered with because it is a blockchain record? Those are questions that are still being worked out in the technological community, but the vocabulary used may mask that those questions are still being asked. So you can have one regulator say, or in one state, you know, the evidence rules could say, yes, blockchain technology is, you know, you can, it's absolutely going to be treated as a golden record for our rules of evidence purposes. And another state may not say so because they have a different viewpoint of the capabilities of the technology. They don't view it as any more authoritative than any other record. And so both states may have the same policy goal of including and allowing evidence into a case that is authoritative and, you know, helpful and relevant and something reliable, but because they have different understandings of what the technology's capabilities are, in part because of vocabulary issues, they may end up treating it very differently.
Yeah, and then, so then the problem of perverse innovation, what is that and what causes that?
So perverse innovation, it's kind of a fancy term for, you know, workarounds or finding the loopholes. So people do this all the time, right? That's in part what lawyers do for their clients, is you look at what the law is and you try to enable your client to do what they want to do while still in compliance with the law. So if regulators, through a misunderstanding perhaps about the technology, or perhaps through unclear communications themselves about the technology because of the unsettled vocabulary, they pass something and people tinker with what they're doing in order to avoid the consequences of the regulation. And I think this becomes more likely when no one is clear about what they're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, there's also problems that are created through overly precise definitions, I think, in that case of perverse innovations. I'm just thinking of an...
Absolutely, yes.
An example... an example that occurred to me, and I don't know if this is the same in America as it is here, but the market for legal highs, so these are drugs that they're somehow legal because they get through some loophole, but they have the same effect as an illegal narcotic drug. And, you know, just slight variations in the molecule within the drug can help it to avoid regulation because it's not one of the named or listed compounds that is illegal.
Sure.
So you've an overly precise regulation.
Yes.
It creates this incentive for people to have these slight variations on the drug in this instance, but on the technology and the blockchain technology in the case that we're talking about, to subvert or avoid those regulations.
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's kind of the rules versus standards debate. However, that rules can maybe perhaps be more easily gained because of their precision, and they may leave stuff out. Standards, they may be broader, but yeah, the interpretation of them is fuzzier. But I think that terminology confusion in this area is problematic because it doesn't allow people to make a good decision about that, right? You may craft a broad definition or a standard, right, intending to have some effect, but because the language is so fuzzy, you may not be achieving your purpose either way. So you could decide to go rigid or you could decide to go loose, but the language may undermine your intent either way.
Yeah, I want to move on, though, to discuss immutability. So this is probably the main example in your paper of a problematic terminology associated with Bitcoin with blockchains. So immutable is an evaluative term. It's often used to identify a real strength of blockchain technology. But yeah, what does it mean? What do people mean when they say that a blockchain is immutable?
Okay, so people refer to blockchain records as immutable, meaning that they're saying that they can't be changed. They're going to exist forever, and that you can rely on them, essentially. That when you look at a blockchain record, you can count on it because you know that it was not able to be changed. It's always reliable. So this is seen as such a fundamental innovation because, wow, it just gives you reliability in so many different ways. Everything we do or many of the human practices that we engage in involve record keeping. Voting has record keeping in it. All of our education has record keeping in it. All of finance is essentially keeping track of who owns what, who owes what. Everything is record keeping. So if you can actually count on records to be reliable and unchanged, the idea is that, well, you can get rid of all the cheating because it's tamper-proof. I can always know that I voted a particular way or that I paid a certain obligation off. And that's what people mean when they say immutable, and that's why it is seen as so desirable.
Yeah, so I think that's a good answer to that question of the virtue of immutability and why people use the term. But do people use the term appropriately? Is a blockchain actually an immutable record?
So I hate the term, and I would argue for banning the term. It's funny because I think more people are now acknowledging that. So in my paper, I talk about how prevalent the use is of the term immutable and terms that are essentially synonyms with immutable, such ones that you see are that it's permanent or unchangeable. right? Tamper-proof, meaning that it just, no one can mess with it. And I think it's extremely problematic to be referring to the technology as having that characteristic. And I discuss two reasons why I think it's so problematic. First, it's been empirically shown in several public blockchains not to be immutable, in that it's actually been changed. And then the second one is a little bit more complicated, the second argument, but that it's misleading to call all blockchain technology immutable because it's unclear where immutability comes from, what gives rise to an immutable record with the technology. And because, as I said, as we talked about earlier, there have been so many different tweaks to the technology over time, it's unclear, you know, which forms of the technology, if any, would still create an immutable record.
Yeah, so maybe the first of those arguments, the empirical case, that's possibly the easier one to outline, although it does rely on some technical language like the forking of the blockchain. So maybe you could explain the empirical disproofs of immutability.
Okay, so there have been a few examples of that. And so things that I would consider to be showing that a record is not immutable is if there have actually been changes to what the record is. Okay, so over the course of the last several years, there have been some significant events in some of the more prominent public blockchains that have resulted in changes to them. So one example of that was with Bitcoin in March 2013, there was what is called a hard fork. So a fork in a blockchain happens when this one record essentially splits into two. Okay, so part of the computer network that has been making changes to the record keeps working on one ledger, and part of the network starts working on another ledger. So the record diverges at a certain point. It forks. This happened in 2013 when computers within the processing network, the mining network, were running two different versions of the Bitcoin software. So a portion of the network hadn't upgraded yet to the latest version. And this resulted in that type of network split. So suddenly there are two ledgers being kept. Well, this is a big problem, right? Because it undermines the entire value proposition of the technology, right? There needs to be one true record for it to have value. So people realized this. The developers, the core developers who worked on the system, became aware that the fork had happened, and they sprung into action to try to remedy this. This involved figuring out which of the records was going to be treated as legitimate and contacting enough of the transaction processors, the miners, to get them to move over to a new version or a particular version of the software and say that the chosen version of the ledger was legitimate, and to abandon the other version of the ledger. Okay, this had consequences. It required the miners who were abandoning the chain that they were working on to actually give up some of the earnings that they had made on it. Okay, so they had to act altruistically in this sense, kind of act for the good of the network. But essentially, what that resulted in, related to the immutability point, is that those records on the rejected portion of the ledger, they're gone. They're not immutable. They don't exist. So while they were processed legitimately in accordance with the rules of the system, the humans involved decided that they were not going to be treated as legitimate. So they weren't permanent records. The system did not generate a permanent record in that situation.
Yeah, no. So I mean, that's a very clear example of where, and shows how immutability is to an extent a human construct. It's what we decide as being the authoritative record for the blockchain. That seems to be the critical detail there.
Yes, it absolutely is. So a lot of what I see in the whole space around the technology here is believing essentially that we have escaped many of these inherent flaws of our humanity. You know, we're trying to get away from things that are messy about being people. And one of those is that people can change things because there are mistakes or whatever. And the idea of immutability says, well, we've gotten beyond that. we can create things that are that humans can't mess with, but we always can mess with things. If we make something, we can mess with it, and that's one thing that that 2013 fork does. And I'm happy to talk about the fork after the DAO with Ethereum. That's a very similar example involving rewriting history and a human choice to rewrite history.
Yeah, I mean, so that actually attracted a lot of news last year. So maybe just describe what happened there. We don't need to go into it in as much detail as the Great. Previous example.
Okay, so essentially, there ended up being a theft within the DAO, which was...
Sorry, just maybe explain that acronym and the technology.
Okay, sure. So the DAO stands for the Decentralized Autonomous Organization, and this is one of the systems that people are building on top of the Ethereum blockchain. This was intended to function as essentially a venture capital fund for investments in blockchain technology. And it was intended to just be code running, and participants in the system would have the opportunity to vote, and the code would implement their votes on which investments to make, and it would all be perfect. And there was a bug in the code that was created. And there were many investments made into this fund, I think around $150 million. And shortly after it was created, this bug resulted in someone who has still not been revealed actually stealing around $50 or $60 million worth of Ether from the other participants in the venture fund, the DAO. So this raised a lot of questions for everyone involved in the Ethereum blockchain, particularly the core developers who run the software, make changes to it, help keep the network going. They had to decide whether they were going to try to treat this as a theft, the taking of the money, or whether they were going to treat it as just code running, and everyone who signed up for the DAO agreed that whatever the code does is whatever the code does. The code is law. So this was a big fundamental question for the system. And the developers, the core developers for Ethereum, decided that they were going to treat it as a theft and write new code that would result in taking the funds back, essentially, from the hacker by rewriting the record so that the theft hadn't happened. So the record ended up being rewritten to essentially erase the theft. So again, humans were involved in making a choice about whether the record was going to be immutable, unchangeable, permanent. And in this case, they decided it was not going to be. Now, interestingly, that resulted in this dispute about how to treat the theft. Was it a theft, or was it something we just lived with? And whether or not to change the record was such a divisive question that the network, the Ethereum network, actually did split. Part of the network went with the decision to take the funds back from the thief, and part of the network said, no, we're keeping that record and we're going to proceed as is. So we now have an Ethereum blockchain, the one that remedied the theft, and an Ethereum classic blockchain in which they didn't remedy the theft and continued on with the record as is.
Yeah, again, another clear example of how misleading it is to refer to the record as immutable, because these choices have been made to treat, or different groups have differed on their attitude to which record is in fact the authoritative and legitimate record.
Yes.
The other argument you have, the more conceptual argument, I mean, how would you explain that to somebody? So, why do you think immutability is not an appropriate term to apply?
Sure. So in the paper, I use an analogy to help explain this. In baseline terms, I see immutability as an emergent property of blockchains. Like, assuming that immutability exists, I see it as an emergent property. And what I mean by that is this characteristic comes about through this complex system of the blockchain. The stuff that I talked about at the beginning as being potential elements of what we would consider to be a blockchain, this cryptography, people doing stuff in a decentralized way, like some magic there results in creation of an immutable record, okay? And people refer to every variant in general of blockchain technology as immutable. Okay, whether it is a private blockchain, whether it's a public blockchain, whether it's token, has the token, whether it's tokenless, it is very common to simply state that blockchain technology creates an immutable record, full stop. Okay, so I think this is problematic, and perhaps analogizing it to baking a cake might make this clearer. So baking a cake is essentially, you're dealing with a complex system there. Okay, you combine a bunch of ingredients and you apply heat in a particular way, and that helps you determine the quality of the cake that you get out. So if you want a cake that ends up being moist, it's going to matter whether you follow the recipe to put in real butter as opposed to, you know, artificial butter, or whether you bake it at 400 degrees as opposed to 300 degrees, or an hour versus 30 minutes. Okay, all of these are going to affect whether you get this emergent property of moistness. And tweaking any of those can affect whether the cake turns out to be moist. The same, I think, is true about blockchain technology and immutability. Changing and tweaking the different factors that are involved in the blockchain affects the emergent properties that come from the system. And this is, it's very rarely acknowledged in the discussions about the technology, the emerging characteristics from it could change based on the inputs.
Yeah, I mean, just for people who are familiar with philosophical terminology, another way of putting it would be to say that the property of moistness in the case of the cake, or immutability in the case of blockchain, is something that's realizable in different ways. So there's different combinations of the underlying variables that can realize the same emergent phenomenon. And by the same token, tweaking or changing one of those underlying variables can make it not display or express that emergent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult thing to say for sure or for definite whether this particular arrangement will result in immutability or moistness or not. It's
yes, and I'm not the only one who says that. And the reason I point this out is because there is a dispute amongst the technologists in the community about what actually creates immutability. Some say it's the cryptography. Others say it's the particular consensus mechanism that you use. Some say you have to use this proof of work, the mining process of Bitcoin. Others say, no, that doesn't matter. So if nobody knows what is generating the property of immutability, then we don't know whether these different variations are actually creating it.
And also, I mean, important to your argument is that people are going to then be using the same term immutability to talk about different arrangements of those underlying factors or properties.
Absolutely. Yeah. And since immutability particularly is one of the things that people say, well, this is what makes the technology the most amazing thing ever and is going to revolutionize the world because we have an unchangeable record, you better be darn sure that you understand when that characteristic is there and when it's not.
So, I mean, you think we should banish the term immutable?
Yes. I do. I don't think I'm going to win that, but I do.
Would we replace it with anything? Would you put anything in its stead?
I think it's fair to describe things as hard to change. I've also heard some people say that it should be described as tamper resistant, which, you know, I think is better. That also captures the aspect of being hard, but maybe not impossible to change. Immutability is problematic to me because of it's so absolute. It suggests far too much certainty than there actually is.
Yeah, another term that I dislike is the term trustless, and that's often used in relation to Bitcoin in particular as somehow a trustless currency. It removes the need for third-party institutions who verify or confirm things. But I just find that odd because I think it's clearly a kind of just a different type of trust involved in the case of Bitcoin. And I think those examples of cases where the record has been changed clearly illustrate that. And it gets to your point about the attempt to use the technology to avoid the messy aspects of human relationships, the need for trust and cooperation and so forth, doesn't really work because actually these technologies do ultimately rely on the same things, perhaps in a slightly different form.
but they never get away from those messy human realities.
Yes, I would put Trustless on the list as well. The paper was originally going to include studies of Trustless, Immutable, and Secure, but I felt like I had made the point with immutability, but fully agree with you about all the stuff about Trustless. We are absolutely still trusting particular humans to do things for us. And that actually is one of the reasons that I've argued that the core developers, particularly, and the major miners, the transaction verifiers in the network, should actually, they're actually functioning as fiduciaries to people who are counting on it. So people, we're putting trust, significant amounts of trust, in particular people's competence and ethics. You can't get around it.
Yeah, and that's your other article that I mentioned at the outset, and I'll provide a link to that in the show notes for this as well. Okay, so what you point out in the paper that, you know, this isn't just a hypothetical problem. People are really trying to define blockchain technologies for the purposes of regulation already. So, and one example that you use is the Arizona State Legislature. So maybe you could just talk about that example for a bit and some of the problems that arise from the way in which they attempted to define a blockchain.
Sure. So earlier this year, the legislature in Arizona, I think, to demonstrate that they are supportive of this type of technology, passed a statute where they talked about its that smart contracts, which we referred to a little bit earlier, that they may exist in commerce, and that signatures that are secured through a blockchain are treated as electronic signatures. The interesting thing about this statute is the definition that they provide for blockchain technologies, particularly in that they say explicitly in the definition that the data on the ledger is protected with cryptography, is immutable and auditable, and provides an uncensored truth. Okay, so you already know that I would delete immutable because I think it's completely misleading. But putting that in a law suggests that even if empirically the data has been tampered with, we're still going to treat it as immutable. Big problem. Provides an uncensored truth. That to me sounds, I don't know, more like marketing or something for the technology rather than something you would find in a law. And we haven't discussed this, but you know, there's a whole lot of questions around how reliable the data actually is on a blockchain, because you can certainly put false data on a blockchain and have it be validated. So to me, this statute demonstrates that there are at least some regulators who are making laws about the technology, making decisions about the technology without actually understanding what they're doing, and are including these problematic and potentially misleading words in the laws that they're passing, which is a big, big problem.
Yeah, but also, as you kind of hinted at in the introducing that example, we've got to bear in mind that legislatures and regulators aren't just trying to manage the risks with technologies. They have other strategic aims. So this might be a type of marketing to say Arizona is open for business in this area, and that then affects the statutory or legal definition of the concept. So yeah, these other strategic aims can taint the definition or the terminology as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I think we've done a good job kind of outlining all the issues here. We've given some examples and why the terminological confusion arises. Maybe we could just close then by asking the obvious question, which is, what would you do to overcome this confusion?
Okay, so these are not, you know, magic solutions. However, they're pretty basic. One is that people who are trying to really understand the technology need to learn as much as they possibly can, and that the learning process absolutely has to be one that engages critical thinking, and the education process is incomplete unless you are being actively skeptical and really thinking for yourself. So some suggestions that I have in the paper, you know, are ones that regulators and policymakers are definitely engaging in, bringing in experts, having conferences, trying to self-educate, talking with other regulators about how they understand it, watching the standards or organizations, and just trying to learn as much as they can. I think my my recommendations, the more important part is certainly the mindset that they have to use in the learning process. So there is a massive amount, from my perspective, of hype in the space, and I think that the terminology problems can kind of mask that hype sometimes. So you have to work really hard to see through it. You also, I think, with blockchain technology, you have to really think about the incentives of the source that you're looking at. So the regulators, of course, have to be educated in large part by the technologists and companies that are using this technology, because they're the ones that presumably know the most about it. You can't forget, though, that those people have interest in pushing the technology because it will be profitable for them. So you have to question what they're saying.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yes, I think, again, immutability would be a good example here of a term that's, you know, it's so strongly connotes the authority and irrevocability of the record. And it is, at least mm-hmm. in part, due to the marketing hype around the technology, people that want to sell its virtues to others and who themselves might be aware of some of the actual flaws or problems with the technology, that it's maybe not quite as immutable as they're claiming it to be.
Yeah, so there's that aspect, and I would also suggest, as part of this critical thinking, that they should be looking for diversity of thinking in, you know, the sources that they're considering. So if they've read 25 articles about how great the technology is, they should similarly look for sources that are more critical or more balanced. So they should be reading across the spectrum and looking for, you know, diverse viewpoints. And then they can weigh, you know, what they think about the validity of the viewpoint, but they need to be actively seeking out diversity there, trying to avoid groupthink, essentially. I would also say that I think with blockchain technology, it's not a guarantee that something is accurate just because it appears in a source that seems prestigious or credible. There are plenty of articles that refer to immutability about the technology in otherwise credible publications. So with blockchain technology, I would say you have to not assume that just because something is from Harvard or an Ivy League or Oxford or something, that it is necessarily accurate. You still have to engage in your own critical thinking.
Yeah, so I think that's, as you say, sensible advice, it's what you'd expect or hope that regulators are doing in all areas, educating themselves and adopting this kind of critical reflective mindset when it comes to the sources that they're consulting and the what they're reading and so forth.
Yes, you absolutely would hope that. But I mean, I think that there can become trends among regulators, and a little bit of what you were referring to earlier, the competition. So it seems like right now there is very much a competition amongst regulators to appear most open to innovation. And, you know, this, I think, stems from political pressure to, you don't want to be a job killer, right? We want to be open for business. And that may impact whether regulators are skeptical about a new technology or whether they're just like, well, let's go, we need jobs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, that's kind of the phenomenon as well, to an extent of regulatory capture, that the regulators themselves are captured by the interests of the industry that they're trying to regulate or manage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, I think we've covered everything now. I think we'll leave it there. So I'll just close by thanking you again for joining me for this conversation.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.